Major funding for Only a Game is provided by Oliver Wyman. Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Before a practice on Tuesday, Boston Celtics forward Jeff Green was asked if he'd welcome the return of a particular former teammate who'd been traded to Washington earlier in the season.
Well, most definitely. He was an awesome teammate. He played the game hard. You know, he set good screens, got me open, so that's all you can ask for.
Beyond playing the game hard and setting the screens, Green's former teammate remained silent about his sexual orientation until Monday. That's when Jason Collins became the first active player in one of the major male sports to acknowledge that he is gay. John Amici, who came out 4 years after his NBA career ended in 2003, was among the many delighted by the response to Collins' announcement.
All you have to do is check the Twitter feed, and you'll see that the vast majority of feedback is really wonderful, effusively warm. There are still one or two people out there who never really got past the fifth grade. I think Jason is braver than I didn't consider it.
Among those whom Collins alerted before Monday's announcement was the man who coached him when he was with the Celtics, Doc Rivers.
When he called me to tell me, and you could tell he wanted to tell me, I told him before I said, Jason, I can care less about what you're about to tell me. And jokingly said, I wish you could have got me more rebounds, because that's all I care about, really, at the end of the day.
Joining me now is Sports Illustrated executive editor John Wertheim, one of the writers who interviewed Jason Collins for the magazine's exclusive cover story about him. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill.
Tell me a little bit about the circumstances of the genesis of that Collins story, which has received such extraordinary coverage since Monday.
Well, the stories are contributor of ours, Franz Liz, got a call from a boyhood friend of his who's now the agent, Arn Tellem, who said, I have a client, an NBA player, who's thinking about coming out after the season. Might you be interested? This was about April 1st. And they gave us a date of April 24th in Los Angeles. They did not tell us who it was, and honestly, we didn't really ask. Franz and I flew out there. Jason Collins was there to greet us and got to talking. That's pretty much the genesis.
How did Jason Collins seem during the interview? Was he relaxed? Did he seem relieved?
There was a spectrum of emotions. It was humor and some very poignant emotional moments, but nerves or apprehension or this sort of sense of second-guessing, I didn't get that at all. It was a very relaxed, enjoyable conversation among three adults.
Tennis great and activist Martina Navratilova, who came out in 1981, appeared on the Today Show this week. John, let's listen to a little bit of what she had to say.
The media has done it 180, fans have done it 180, and now you're getting support when you come out. So the monkey's off your back. It's like nobody wants to go back in the closet once
right.
They came out.
You called Martina Navratilova to invite her to comment on the circumstances. What stood out during your conversation with her?
What stood out was she was in the prime of her career. I mean, God bless Jason Collins, but we're not talking about LeBron or Kobe here. I mean, Martina was the star in tennis when she came out. She did not know what this would mean. She did not know what price this would exact on her playing career. She was 24 years old, Grand Slam champion. And to me, something that's really been overlooked in the retelling of her story is just the level at which she played after this unprecedented move she made.
What is your sense of what the immediate and more long-term effects of Jason Collins' announcement will be within the sports world?
It's only natural to expect there to be some backlash, but I think when we see Jason Collins in uniform next season, and I do think it's when and not if, this will be a story for a few weeks, and regardless of how many points he scores, he will be interviewed, and 20% of the way through the season, we're going to stop caring.
John Wertheim writes for Sports Illustrated and SI.com. John, thank you very much for speaking with me. A pleasure for me, as always.
Oh, likewise. Thanks, Bill.
Though no one currently playing in the NHL, NFL, or Major League Baseball is openly gay, there have been efforts to foster environments of inclusion and acceptance beyond basketball. Chief among them has been the You Can Play Project, which was founded in 2012 after a car crash claimed the life of openly gay former hockey player Brendan Burke. You Can Play was founded by Brendan's father, then Toronto Maple Leafs general manager Brian Burke, and by his brother Patrick, a scout for the Philadelphia Flyers. In April of this year, the NHL announced its partnership with You Can Play. Joining me is Patrick Burke. Patrick, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me a little bit about You Can Play and its mission.
Well, our idea is that sports is supposed to be for everybody. When you step on the ice, when you step on the court, when you step on the field, whatever it might be, that you should only be judged by what you bring to the team. If you're a contributing player, if you work hard, if you're talented, if you're good enough to help a team win, then you're on that team. So if you can play, you can play. Gay athletes don't get a fair shot to play because they have to deal with harassment and intimidation and stigmas and the type of anti-gay language that gets thrown around a locker room. So our mission is to eliminate that type of language, make an inclusive locker room, and let's make sports better for everybody.
What have you already accomplished as a result of the newly forged partnership with the NHL?
I think the partnership in and of itself is an accomplishment. I mean, you're talking about the first time that any major professional sports league in North America has done an official partnership with an LGBT rights group to this extent, providing us with official access to players, providing players with confidential access to us. 6 months ago, the NHL and the NHLPA were in a heated lockout and couldn't agree on anything. And now they've both agreed that You Can Play is worthy of being an official partner, that LGBT rights are something the hockey community wants to fight for, and that we're all in this together.
Your late brother Brendan came out a year before he passed away. Tell me a little bit about his struggles as a gay athlete and how they inspired you and your father to do something about homophobia in sports.
Well, one of the things that Brendan talked about a lot was that that it was hard to sit in a locker room and hear those words, that no matter who you are, when you're struggling with your own sexual orientation, when you're struggling to discover who you are as a person, it takes a toll on you. Brendan's senior year of high school, he ended up leaving the hockey team in part because of this, and in part because he was worried that his teammates would find out that he was gay. You're talking about the son of a National Hockey League general manager who didn't feel entirely comfortable in a hockey locker room. That kind of made me realize there's a lot of work left to be done, a lot of change that needs to be made to the culture of sports, and I felt that we were in a position to do just that.
Martina Navratilova said this week that Jason Collins' decision to come out will undoubtedly save lives. Do you agree?
Yeah, I do. We do lose kids because of this, because they don't feel at home on their hockey team, on their soccer team, whatever it might be. And without sports, they lose direction. They lose a purpose. They lose something that they care so much about, that we do know that there are kids out there who, because of losing a sport, end up losing much, much more than that. So I agree entirely. I think what Jason's doing is absolutely going to save lives and also improve lives, just make kids feel a little bit safer, a little bit better about themselves. And I think that's important.
I understand that when You Can Play began, you envisioned a time when the organization would no longer be necessary. What was your original estimate regarding the end date of You Can Play, and did that estimate change soon after Jason Collins made his announcement?
We signed on for an 8-year commitment. With everything that's happened since we launched, with the official partnership, with the work that we're now doing with other leagues, and with Jason Collins, I'm not sure it's going to take 8 years. I think it might be something where in 5 years we can go and disband, or whether it's handed down to the next generation of sports activists or whatever it might be. But now it's kind of like we're almost done already.
Patrick Burke is a co-founder of You Can Play and a scout with the Philadelphia Flyers. Patrick, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Joining me now to discuss the NHL playoffs and specifically how the defending champion Los Angeles Kings are faring so far is the LA Times' Helene Elliott. Welcome back, Helene.
Thank you.
We'll talk about the Kings in just a moment, but since we just spoke with Patrick Burke of You Can Play, I want to ask you if you've seen evidence in the early going that the group's partnership with the NHL has changed the atmosphere around the league.
I think it absolutely has. Earlier this week, we talked to a number of players about Jason Collins, and I asked a number of hockey players whether a gay player would be accepted in the NHL, and it was like, why are you even asking? Of course. David Backes, the captain of the St. Louis Blues, was saying, we don't care. The idea is, if you're a good teammate, if you're going to help me win, I want you on my team. I don't care about anything beyond that. Dustin Brown, who's the captain of the Kings, said, look, I have friends who are gay. I have relatives who are gay. I don't care. What I care is that you're a good teammate. That's all that matters.
The Los Angeles Kings now find themselves down 0-2 in the first round of the playoffs. Both losses came in close games in St. Louis. Do the Kings feel they can come back?
Yeah, but it would really help if they could score some goals. They tried that route last year, but they were getting timely goals. Now they're not getting anything. In game one, the only goal they scored was after they had pulled the goalie in favor of an extra skater. And in game two, the only goal they scored was a 5-on-3 power play goal. So it would behoove them to start scoring at even strength at some point, or else they're going to have an earlier summer than they anticipated.
The Blues scored with 50 seconds left in regulation to win Game 2, and they won the previous game in overtime in stunning fashion. Some have called Game 1 one of the greatest postseason games in the history of the NHL. You were there. Have they got that right?
I think it certainly ranks up there. I mean, Jonathan Quick made 40 saves in that game, and he was the only reason they got to overtime. And then he makes a misplay behind his own net with the puck in the overtime. And the Blues player, Alex Steen, was very alert, made a terrific play, took the puck away from Quick, and wrapped it around and into the net. So in terms of drama, in terms of tension, of physicality, I mean, it's been great drama the first two games. These are two very evenly matched teams, very physical teams. They're fighting for every inch of ice, and it's just been great to watch.
Jonathan Quick, Kings goalie, won the Conn Smythe Trophy last year as the postseason MVP. It doesn't sound as if he's been figured out by opponents exactly.
Yeah, it's been fluky things. The winning goal in Game 2, the Blues had a 3-on-2 rush, and one of Quick's defensemen, Drew Doughty, actually screened him on it. It was kind of a soft shot, so people are thinking, oh, that's a terrible goal. But if you analyze it, I don't think Quick saw it at all. He played so well. And to lose two games, the one in overtime and then this one in literally the last minute, it's really going to be a test for him and for that team. You know, they rolled through the playoffs last year. They took 3-0 lead in every series that they played last year. And now here they are down 0-2. So I'm curious to see how they respond when they get home.
Helene Elliott covers the Kings and the NHL for the Los Angeles Times. Helene, thank you as always.
Thank you.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Tim Tebow lost his job with the New York Jets on Monday, and the new offers began rolling in almost immediately. Would Mr. Tebow like to join the Omaha Beef for some indoor football? The Beef offered to make it worth his while to the tune of $75 per game. When current Beef quarterback James McNair learned of the offer, he said, "I think Tim can learn a lot from me." No? Well, the Legends Football League, known as the Lingerie Football League until they began requiring their players to dress more warmly, was also in touch. They offered Tebow the opportunity to sign on as the league's national quarterbacks coach, which sounds a good deal more impressive than local quarterbacks coach.
They're winning on Tebow time. Winning on Tebow time. Winning on Tebow time.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, the discovery of footage believed to be the earliest film of African-American ballplayers. But first, the horses racing in this weekend's Kentucky Derby are undoubtedly proud of their talents and understandably excited about their prospects beyond racing. But they've got nothing on 2009 Derby winner Mind That Bird, who's currently enjoying retirement and preparing to have his story told on the silver screen, as was the case with the great Secretariat and Seabiscuit. From member station WFPL in Louisville, Gabe Bullard has this report on Hollywood's next leading horse.
Mind That Bird, the 2009 Kentucky Derby winner and the inspiration for the upcoming movie 50-1, isn't out to stud. He's a gelding, so that's not really a possibility. Maybe that's why he's in such a bad mood, thrashing around in his trailer. Well, barn. Or maybe the star is just temperamental. Bird is in residence at the Kentucky Derby Museum next to Churchill Downs, greeting tourists and any equine paparazzo who pass through. And it's opportune timing. This weekend, post-production work is expected to wrap on 50-1, which will tell the story of how an underappreciated thoroughbred owned by a group of New Mexico cowboys came to win the Kentucky Derby with, yes, 50-1 odds.
And they're off! in the Kentucky Derby.
At the 2009 Derby, Pioneer of the Nile and Dunkirk were favored to win at 4-1. But Mind That Bird broke from far behind to sneak along the rail and win the race, surprising almost everyone watching, including the announcers.
And a spectacular, spectacular upset. Mind That Bird has won the Kentucky Derby. An impossible result here.
That never really entered our mind that we could even win that thing.
Dr. Leonard Block is one of Mind That Bird's owners. He and his partners almost didn't enter the horse into the Derby. And when they did, they themselves drove him to Louisville in a trailer.
We were just hoping that we could make a decent showing, you know, and run up in the pack someplace. But we didn't realize, I guess, you know, what a story could be made out or a movie could be made out of that.
But someone did realize it. Jim Wilson is the writer and director of 50-1. Wilson is actually the second filmmaker to try to turn the story into a movie. That's fast, considering Mind That Bird won the Derby only 4 years ago. It took decades for Secretariat or Seabiscuit to make it to the multiplex.
I think when you see a good story, and I've waited many, many years for a good story, you snap it up and you make it. So the fact that it's, you know, 4 years after the fact, I don't think it's too recent at all. I think people's memories are ridiculously short.
But the studios thought it was too soon, especially coming just 3 years after Disney's Secretariat.
In truth, no one was that keen to make another horse racing story. So I took it to market about a year ago, and they weren't keen on it. So I said, well, we'll put it together ourselves.
Wilson had to make the movie without a distributor. He's hoping the underdog story will catch the studios and the public's attention once he finishes the final cut, and the film will see a wide release. Wilson is taking a big risk. It's not easy to make a movie independently, especially if that movie is centered on horse racing.
Oh my gosh, the challenges. Well, they're never ending. I mean, first of all, you're dealing with, if you just take the horse aspect of it, you know, you're doing everything that they do, you know, in a real live race. You're loading in gates, you're going down the backstretch at full speed, you're, you know, having to film all that, not just watch it. So that's as difficult as I'll get out.
Churchill Downs Vice President John Asher says the Secretariat movie crew also had plenty of frustrations with race scenes, especially when it came to recreating the 1973 Derby, when Secretariat toppled second-place finisher Sham.
But in a lot of those races coming down the stretch, the Secretariat they had wasn't that interested in beating Sham that day. You know, they had, the jocks really had to kind of pull on them, and to get the desired finish, they weren't exactly riding them out to the wire.
And there are other challenges as well. Some of Churchill Downs' features have changed since 1973. So have fashions.
A lingering memory of that Secretariat shoot being here was the overwhelming, suffocating amount of polyester that was on display. Because, you know, it's all these leisure suits. And
there are few leisure suits to be seen at Churchill Downs these days, but John Asher says there's one thing horse racing fans can always count on.
When you open the gate, you don't know what's going to happen, but when those happen, people really tend to embrace these horses, and winning a Kentucky Derby is just special anyway.
Wilson will start shopping his movie to studios soon, and even though Mind That Bird may not be a household name like Seabiscuit or Secretariat, he's done pretty well for an underdog before. For Only a Game, I'm Gabe Bullard in Louisville.
While Jackie Robinson was getting the Hollywood treatment with a blockbuster movie 42, a much lesser-known African-American baseball hero was also getting his due. In 1878, John Jackson, a.k.a. Bud Fowler, became the first African-American to play professional baseball with white men, almost seven decades before Robinson broke Major League Baseball's color barrier. His career spanned more than 30 years as a player, manager, and entrepreneur. Fowler grew up in Cooperstown, New York, the home of the Baseball Hall of Fame, and last month the town recognized his story of perseverance in the face of bigotry. North Country Public Radio's David Summerstein was there.
The Baseball Hall of Fame's exhibit about African Americans in the national pastime is called Pride and Passion. A giant photo of Jackie Robinson at the plate is splashed across one wall. old-time jazz plays quietly.
I'm standing right now in front of Jackie Robinson's Brooklyn Dodgers uniform, number 42. And if you walk across the exhibit, right over here, you will see in a timeline, 1878, first African-American professional player, Bud Fowler, plays for pay in Lynn, Massachusetts, on a team in the Minor League International Association. And that's the only mention of him.
There's a picture, too, only one of two known to exist. But Fowler's a footnote here. Yet among baseball scholars, he's considered a giant of the game.
Bud Fowler is of extraordinary importance on a national scale. Many would argue that he should be in the Hall of Fame or should have been in long ago.
John Thorne is the official historian for Major League Baseball. He says while three black men played Major League games before the so-called Gentlemen's Agreement erected the color barrier in 1887, none had a longer-lasting career than Fowler.
He's a 300 batter. He's a fine fielder at second base. The press accolades for his play for Binghamton in the International League in 1887 match those of any player in the league. He and Frank Grant and pitcher George Stovey in 1886 with Newark, these were first-rate stars, and the only thing stopping them from ascent to the major leagues was prejudice.
Fowler was born John W. Jackson. His family moved to Cooperstown when he was two. His father was a barber, one of the few African-American professions respected by whites. Village historian Hugh McDougall says just 28 black people lived in Cooperstown at the time. Jackson was one of only six black children in the local school.
So he was going to school with essentially white school kids. He learned how to play baseball with white kids. I think he always felt that he ought to be able to live in the white community.
It's a mystery why Jackson changed his name to Fowler, perhaps to protect his family. After his professional baseball debut with the Lynn Live Oaks, Fowler played in Ontario, in New Orleans, in Virginia. In all, Fowler played for or managed more than two dozen teams in 17 states, from Maine to Texas. To make a living in between gigs, he barbered like his dad. At each stop, says MLB historian John Thorne, prejudice forced him to pack his bags.
He felt that he needed to become an itinerant ball player. He would join a club, find that some white players objected to his presence, and 6 weeks later he was gone.
He endured jeers and threats from the crowd. He wore wooden slats under his pant legs because white players would try to spike him as they slid into second base. Ryan Leichenauer helped design a new exhibit about Fowler's life that's on display in the village of Cooperstown. There's a photo in it of Fowler with the Keokuk, Iowa team in 1885. Leichenauer says it shows Fowler's determination and isolation.
You see Bud Fowler in the middle, looking strong, prominent, and surrounded by him is a team of white faces sort of to the side. And knowing his story, you can just look at that picture and sort of infer that experience of he's a lone pioneer in this game.
On April 20th, about 100 years after Bud Fowler's death, the village of Cooperstown finally honored that pioneering legacy.
Briefly, welcome everybody to Bud Fowler Day. We're going to start here.
Village Mayor Jeff Katz stands with about 50 people on a little side street that leads directly to Doubleday Field, the mythical birthplace of baseball in this village of 1,800 people in upstate New York.
This entrance to Doubleday Field was a street without a name, and we had a name looking for a street.
Three captains of the high school baseball team wear uniforms with the name Fowler printed across their backs. They snip a ribbon and unveil a new street sign. It reads Fowler Way. Yay! Mayor Katz says it's about time Cooperstown recognized its most storied local player.
A 19th century son of a black barber struggling to play professional baseball is not quite someone that, let's say, the village perceives as one of their own. And yet he is one of our own. He is a fellow resident, a fellow citizen of this village, who did an amazing thing.
The whole idea for Bud Fowler Day was Tom Schiebers. He's the Baseball Hall of Fame senior curator.
It's not so much a story of baseball. It's a story of continuing to do what you love and not letting someone say no because of the color of your skin or for whatever reason. And I think that's something to honor.
In the years before he died, Bud Fowler formed his own clubs. One, the Page Fence Giants in Michigan, became the prototype for all black baseball teams to come. When MLB historian John Thorne gave his speech at the ceremony, he invoked the giant figure of Jackie Robinson, who walked across a bridge built by so many African-American ballplayers who came before him. Thorne said he was certain Robinson had traveled down Fowler Way. For Only a Game, I'm David Summerstein in Cooperstown, New York.
To view David Summerstein's pictures of the Cooperstown event honoring Bud Fowler, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. As David Summerstein was preparing his story about Bud Fowler, the University of Georgia announced that it had discovered the oldest known film footage of African-American baseball players. Joining me now is New York Times reporter Robbie Brown, who wrote this week about that discovery. Robbie, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me where this footage was found and who found it.
So there's a plantation in South Georgia called Pebble Hill Plantation. This was a early 20th century, late 19th century plantation where a family from Ohio would come down to Georgia in the winters. And deep in the archives of one of the buildings on that plantation were a bunch of old film reels. And recently the family donated boxes of reels to the University of Georgia. And the family said, we don't exactly know what's on these, but we think there might be something of historic significance. And so university archivists have been slowly going through these reels and were struck by this 26-second video of African-Americans playing baseball, which they now believe is the oldest such footage ever found.
Now, the footage lasts just 26 seconds. It allegedly was taken 90-odd years ago, roughly 1917, somewhere in there. Why is it significant?
Well, we knew that blacks played baseball at that point. This is in an era before the Negro Leagues are even created, when the game is entirely recreational for African Americans. We knew that there were blacks playing the game, but we didn't know that much about it. There were selective photos from recreational games that had been found and some documentation of blacks playing baseball going back to the mid-19th century, but we didn't have any video of it. And I think it takes you there to be able to see people playing it. It also just provides more information about a relatively unknown form of the game, which is matches between different plantations in the South, which apparently at the time were fairly common enough for these teams to have uniforms and for games to be arranged between neighboring plantations.
And significant enough for somebody to bring out a camera, which was a pretty new device at that point, I guess.
That's exactly right.
I'm speaking with New York Times reporter Robbie Brown, and you're listening to Only a Game. The University of Georgia asserts that this is the oldest film of African-American ballplayers, but the Baseball Hall of Fame says that it has not determined if this is the case. Why are they dubious?
Well, that's right. There are only so many clues in the film itself, and even the University of Georgia acknowledges that it isn't certain. But here's what the clues are. The footage itself is not dated, but we know that the camera that was used was purchased in 1915, and most of the footage that's on these reels is from somewhere around that era, so the 5 or 10 years after the camera was purchased. There are also photographs that match up with the video that was shot here, and if you analyze them in really careful detail, you can tell there are differences from one year to the next. For instance, the socks that players use. And so the archivists at the University of Georgia have compared these photographs, which are dated, to the video, and they believe that that suggests that this video was shot somewhere between 1917 and 1919. But like you said, there are other experts who are going through this and have not reached a determination.
Does this suggest the function of baseball at this point in time for these folks?
It seems like it's purely recreational. In part of the clip, you can see people on the sidelines watching or waiting to play. But this is not in a stadium. This is in an open field. Mm-hmm. There are not many spectators, if any. We never see somebody hit a ball. We see players sort of scurrying around the field or walking off. It's really unclear what point in the game the footage was shot. And so the assumption was that this was a purely recreational form for people who worked at the plantation. We know that there were baseball teams organized at that point, at lots of companies, steel mills or at factories, there would be a baseball team for blacks and one for whites. This was just sort of a southern equivalent of that. The dominant employer at the time was plantations, and if you had enough plantation workers to field a baseball team, then you might put your team up against neighboring plantations.
Can we expect other similar treasures to be discovered in the coming years or decades?
So that's what they're hoping, is that if they put the video online, which they have, then hopefully somebody will be motivated to come forward and say, that actually isn't the earliest, I have an earlier one. and that's what they're hoping will happen.
Robbie Brown is a New York Times reporter. You can find a link to his column, Antique Film of Black Ballplayers Surfaces and Their Diamond is a Plantation, by visiting our website, onlyagame.org. Robbie, thanks for speaking with me.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Eton, offering the American Red Cross radio line, a portable solar-powered radio with cell phone charger and flashlight for emergencies or travel, now at Best Buy. This is NPR.
The Ultimate Fighting Championship event last weekend in Newark, New Jersey, left officials determined to adjust some of the rules of the sport. Two fights ended because of eye pokes, one of which did not seem all that serious to those in attendance, perhaps since they weren't the ones who got poked in the eye. A consensus emerged that the referees needed a clearer understanding of how to handle eye pokes, whether intentional, accidental, serious, or inconsequential, dual, or singular. That being the case, at the UFC's annual Association of Boxing Commission meeting this summer in San Antonio, the first order of business will be addressing eye poking. Kind of makes you wish you were going to be there, doesn't it? I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the courtship of baseball and beer, a match made in St. Louis. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce from Washington, D.C. this week for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
And beer came first. Remember that.
That's what I'm told. It's been less than a week since the first male professional athlete in a major sport came out as gay, and the sky hasn't fallen. And in fact, everyone from President Obama to Karl Malone has praised NBA free agent Jason Collins. Have you been surprised at the overwhelmingly positive reaction to this story?
Among the elite athletes and elite celebrities, I'm not surprised by this at all. I think it will be a considerably bigger event when some star high school center in a town you've never heard of comes out in his local newspaper, because I think that's where the real impact of this decision is going to be made or not made.
The Golden State Warriors became the underdogs to watch in the NBA postseason currently underway with their exciting Game 6 win over the Denver Nuggets. What do you think? Can they keep it up against the San Antonio Spurs in the Western Conference semifinal?
No, because the San Antonio Spurs are a bunch of stubborn old men who won't get out of the way. I mean, this is a team that, you know, according to all the experts, passed its sell-by date 2 years ago. They just get to the playoffs and they don't lose.
LeBron James has pledged $1 million to build a new gym for his alma mater, St. Vincent St. Mary High School. And in addition, he's buying the latest style of new uniforms for all the teams at that school. And he's sending a gift to this year's graduating class. So how long before they name the place King James High School?
I don't know, but I think he's probably got the inside track for Alumnus of the Year.
The Pittsburgh Penguins had been anxiously awaiting the return of their star, Sidney Crosby, since young Mr. Crosby took a slap shot to the face back on March 30th. He's back now, and the Penguins are playing the New York Islanders, a team that Crosby has performed particularly well against this season. Good timing by him, huh?
Yeah, I think it's a good way for him to work back into the playoffs, and it's certainly good for the NHL to have him back.
It has always been big news when franchise records are broken, except when that franchise is the 19-year-old Anaheim Ducks. This week, Francois Beauchemin set a Ducks record for goals by a defenseman in the Stanley Cup playoffs, and when a reporter told him that he had done that, Beauchemin's response was, "Oh, really?" So it's it's good to know they're paying attention to history out there in Orange County.
I was about to say, in Orange County, history is what happened at Chipotle 15 minutes ago.
The Atlanta Falcons are planning what has been termed, quote, a futuristic stadium. It's going to cost about $1 billion as long as there are no cost overruns, and I'm sure there won't be any. It will include something called a, quote, center oculus and impact seats, whatever they might be, and I wonder if it will also include a good football team.
That's really great in case the NFL ever expands to, like, the Klingon Empire. What on earth is a great central oculus?
Oh, this one I do know. It's a roof that opens like the shutter eye of a camera.
Okay, and to what purpose besides letting like the outside in? Are there going to be sound effects? Because that would be great. It's all fun and games until the folks from Andromeda show up and start eating people. That's all I've got to say. I'm making jokes because I'm still stuck on the whole $1 billion stadium thing.
Despite a new poll suggesting that 4 out of 5 Americans support the name of the NFL franchise right there in Washington, City Councilman David Grosso is proposing the name be changed to the Red Tails after the nickname of the Tuskegee Airmen. He says fans could still sing the team song since the new name has the same number of syllables as the old name, so I guess that's settled.
Yeah, it's a big deal down here. They should get rid of the nickname. The nickname is a racial slur, and it's embarrassing to them, and it's embarrassing to the city, and it's embarrassing to the NFL, and it's embarrassing to the 21st century. I'm perfectly fine with Red Tails.
Pitcher Clay Buchholz, who's been having a fantastic season with the Boston Red Sox so far, was accused this week of throwing spitballs. Jack Morris, a pretty good pitcher himself in his day and now a broadcaster, says Buchholz is doing the same thing Gaylord Perry, quote, made a career out of. Well, certainly worked for Perry.
I was about to say, and your point is?
He's in the Hall of Fame.
Although, isn't it terrific, though, to have, like, a real baseball controversy again instead of talking about, like, biochemistry and stuff?
I am all for it, absolutely. Tom Ricketts, the owner of the Cubs, is so concerned about possibly not being allowed to add a big video screen to Wrigley Field that this week he has threatened to move the team, and the Independent League Schaumburg Boomers have offered up their 7,000-seat stadium to the Cubs, but only if the Cubs give the Boomers first dibs on game dates. How can they turn down that deal? Sounds terrific.
It's an example that the owners of and fans of the Schaumburg Boomers recognize what a joke Tom Ricketts is as an owner. He's not going to move the Cubs from Wrigley. He's not going to be the most hated man in Chicago for the rest of his life. And just because they won't let him add a video screen, he's going to have his little tantrum and the Schaumburg people are going to laugh at him.
Monday night was Josh Hamilton Appreciation Night at the Oakland Coliseum. Hamilton plays for the visiting Anaheim Angels, but last year, while with the Texas Rangers, he dropped a fly ball that helped the A's win the American League West. So what do you think Hamilton did when, on his night, A's fans started throwing Butterfingers candy bars at him during pregame warmups?
First, giant props to A's fans for thinking up the idea of throwing Butterfingers at him, but even bigger props to Josh Hamilton for picking up the candy bars and eating them. This didn't happen when people used to throw, like, batteries at people.
No, exactly right. And finally, Charlie, fans of the Bulgarian soccer team CSKA Sofia are upset about the way their team is being run. Early this week, some of them dug a big hole in the middle of the field where CSKA Sofia plays, and they put up a tombstone inscribed with the name of the company that owns the team. I don't know whether these fans should be applauded for creativity or charged with vandalism. What do you think?
Well, they should be really applauded if they fill the great big hole with Butterfingers. But how did they manage to get into the stadium and dig the big hole?
I think security was probably lax.
I think security was in on the gag is what I think.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, among other places. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Bicyclists are welcoming the warmer weather, in which ice and snow are no longer concerns. In lots of cities and towns, they're finding designated cycling lanes. But as commentator Susan Sabin learned through tragic experience, they cannot be sure of their safety.
As a cyclist, I share the road with drivers in vehicles that outweigh me by 3,900 pounds or more. If I needed sobering, that alone would do it. But I don't. My biking buddies and I, retired, responsible adults, try to minimize the dangers by knowing the rules of the road and obeying them. But we love the sport and get together whenever we can. They say it's good for you. Until it's not. 2 years ago, at the halfway point in a group ride, my husband took off alone to get to a meeting while the rest of us finished a leisurely lunch. I never saw him alive again. Here's what I know about the accident. It was a beautiful spring day with perfect visibility and road conditions. My husband, helmet, bright clothes, pedal reflectors, was riding in the breakdown lane of a straight country road. The sun was not angling into the driver's eyes. She came from behind and swerved right to the side of the road. Although she was not speeding, the impact of her car lifted my husband and smashed him against her windshield with such force that he was catapulted into the air and landed 60 feet away. He arrived at the hospital dead. Here is what I can't know for sure, but believe. The driver was not paying attention. She will forever replay the accident in her head, wishing she'd left home 3 minutes earlier, 3 minutes later, or noticed my husband 3 seconds sooner. Her life, like mine, is changed forever. Drivers don't want to kill, but they must behave as if a defenseless cyclist is sharing the road with them, because more and more that is so. Cyclists may test a driver's patience to the point of frustration, weave in and out of traffic, double up, and chat as if in a tea room. No matter. A car wins in any encounter with a bike, or loses if it kills.
Susan Sabin writes about family and sports from Wellesley, Massachusetts. You can share your ideas about how to make the road safer for cyclists by visiting our Facebook page, facebook.com/onlyagameradio. That's facebook.com/onlyagameradio. In the 1882 version of professional baseball, Chris Vanderay saw an opportunity to sell beer. It was a good thing for baseball that he did, since at least according to Edward Acorn, the author of a new book titled The Summer of Beer and Whiskey, otherwise baseball might not have flourished as it did. Edward Acorn joins me now from WGUC in Cincinnati. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
Tell us a little bit about the world of professional baseball as Chris Vanderay entered it in the 1880s and why some feared that the game at that time might not endure.
Yeah, the game was really on the ropes in the early 1880s. It had been all but destroyed by gambling corruption and also sort of a rowdy quality at the ballparks. And people just didn't like to go out and see the game anymore. Some people in Philadelphia, for instance, tried to revive the game and went around to the local sports editors. They said, don't talk to us about that old crow. They thought it was fading out and was ready to die. Vanderay was a grocer and saloon keeper. He was a German immigrant who had come over in the 1860s with nothing. He invested his life savings in baseball, and he made a fortune.
But basically, originally, saw baseball as an opportunity to collect a lot of thirsty people together and sell them beer, right?
That's right. His perspective on this whole thing was he saw baseball as a sort of an inducement to drink beer, sort of like pretzels. I should explain, there was one major league at the time, the National League. It was trying to clean up baseball's reputation. So it charged a high admission price, 50 cents, which doesn't sound like much now, but was a lot then. It refused to have any Sunday baseball games, and it barred beer at the ballpark. Now, along came Vanderay, who did the exact opposite. He sold beer at the park, he had Sunday baseball, and he charged only 25 cents. All that permitted people, working people and immigrants who were, you know, toiling 6 days a week in these factories and so forth, to come out on Sunday and with their families and enjoy baseball and drink a beer. And that dramatically increased the reach of the game and its popularity.
You write that for all his enthusiasm, Mr. Vondere, quote, never quite seemed to grasp the intricacies of baseball. How did you come to that conclusion?
Well, he was an interesting character. He's an amazingly shrewd businessman, and he put together the structure of these teams that won four straight pennants and in a World Series, which was a quite remarkable achievement. But he also didn't seem to quite get what baseball was about. He once had a sports writer, and he was showing him his park, and he bragged that he had the biggest infield in baseball. He meant the actual field, you know, and the reporter had to explain, no, they're all the same size. And he also would go into the clubhouse after a game and start screaming at the players, why did you drop that ball? As if they did it on purpose or something.
As if they could explain. In February of 1883, there came to be a truce called the National Agreement, whereby the two competing leagues in existence at that time built what you have termed the framework for organized baseball down to this day. But wait, Chris Vondere opposed that agreement. How does he get credit for saving baseball?
Well, he was the last holdout. He actually wanted to drive the National League into the ground, and he might have succeeded, but the two leagues came together and made peace. And essentially that meant that the new league that Vondere helped create, the American Association, respected the reserve clause, which goes way back in baseball. That's the clause whereby you stay with your team and you can't just jump to another team at the end of the season. So he reluctantly accepted that, but he thought he could easily outbid these other owners and get all the best players in baseball.
At this point, we should perhaps acknowledge that Mr. Vondere's efforts to sell beer and save baseball might not have been as successful if the summer of 1883 hadn't also offered fans a terrific pennant race, right?
Oh, I loved this season. It was this great pennant race between four American Association teams. This is one of the reasons I love early baseball, is you can pull out these incredible stories that nobody's ever heard.
Humility was not among Chris Vondere's virtues. He eventually built a statue of himself that stood outside Sportsman's Park in St. Louis for a time. Was he afraid that if he didn't build it himself, nobody else would?
Possibly. I mean, that might be part of it, but his whole career, he just was this figure who loved to be the center of attention. You know, he had the statue commissioned and put it outside the ballpark, and then when he lost everything late in his life, he went bankrupt, he moved it to his gravesite, and it still stands there over his grave in St. Louis.
There's a particularly effective moment, I think, in the book where you describe Mr. Vondere coming out to see a parade related to the ball team that he once owned.
Yes, he comes out, and some people recognize him, and he starts crying, and he's so embarrassed he goes back inside the building. And that was just a sad ending for a man who had done so much to bring baseball to life in St. Louis.
Now, you indicated in the Summer of Beer and Whiskey that you think Mr. Vondere should be in the Hall of Fame. Make your case.
Well, I mean, he founded the St. Louis Cardinals. He helped found this new major league. He made baseball fun and exciting again. He really encouraged the marriage of beer and baseball, which I think is a marriage made in heaven. His teams were extremely successful, four straight pennants. I think this goes back to in the early days of the Hall of Fame, there was a prejudice against the American Association. It was sort of stuffed with National League, American League types, and they didn't view this rowdy league with much esteem. So I think he should be in the Hall, and I'm hoping this will wake up some people to just how big a contribution he made.
Edward Acorn is the author of The Summer of Beer and Whiskey, How Brewers, Barkeeps, Rowdies, Immigrants, and a Wild Pennant Fight Made Baseball America's Game. And the book is published by Public Affairs. The author joined me from WGUC in Cincinnati. Mr. Acorn, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. It was lots of fun.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our intern is Martin Kessler. We had help this week from Don Danko at WGUC in Cincinnati and from Paul Vitkus. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from L.A. Times hockey writer Helene Elliott.
Oh, gosh. You know, you always ask the tough questions, don't you?
You're darn right, Helene, and I expect to get the tough answers that I'm looking for. This is hockey. This is serious. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. See you next week.
Support comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. The SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence at thescanfoundation.org. And the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to a vigorous presence for poetry in American culture. PoetryFoundation.org. This is NPR.